Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
The verdicts had been read. The gavel had fallen. For the state, it was justice served. For the families of 5 teenage boys, it was their futures disappearing. Rayshawn Banner, Nathaniel Cawthon, Jermall Tolliver, Christopher Bryant, and Darrell Brayboy. 5 names now bound together by a crime they swore they didn't commit. 5 boys who walked into a courtroom as children and walked out in shackles, labeled murderers. Their mothers wept as deputies led them away, and the city of Winston-Salem tried to move on. But behind the headlines and the words justice served, something was still unsettled. Because even after the verdicts, the questions never stopped. The judge's words that day still echo through the record, his voice final and unforgiving. He told the courtroom he had seldom seen less willingness to accept responsibility or more resistance to showing remorse. He said the blood of Nathaniel Jones would forever be on these individuals' hands. But was the reason they couldn't show remorse because they had nothing to be remorseful for? The judge's words, meant to condemn, would take on a different meaning in the years that followed. What if the truth wasn't in the courtroom that day at all? What if it was still waiting to be uncovered in an evidentiary hearing more than 2 decades later? From the start, the Winston-Salem 5 maintained their innocence. But it wasn't until decades later that people finally began to listen. Experts challenged the evidence. Psychologists dissected the interrogations, and the prosecution's star witness recanted her testimony. The physical evidence, untouched for more than 20 years, was finally tested for DNA, and the results were shocking. The jurors in the Winston-Salem 5 trials heard 2 carefully curated versions of the truth, shaped by objections, rules, and what the court allowed them to see. But what about the story they never heard? Like the changing testimonies and missing evidence. That truth lived outside the jury box. This is what happened outside of the trial. The doubts that grew and the fight that refused to die. It's a story of what it takes to reverse a conviction and how the truth can prevail even when hope almost doesn't. The prosecution says they were looking for an easy target. The defense says they were the targets. But it's the jurors who have the final say. This is 13th Juror Podcast, where we break down real court cases and put you in the juror's seat. 2 sides, the same evidence. You decide what to believe. I'm your host, Brandi Churchwell. Today's episode is North Carolina versus the Winston-Salem 5, Part 3, Beyond the Jury Box. The verdicts were final. The sentences had been handed down. 5 teenage boys from Winston-Salem entered prison as children, 14 and 15 years old. And life as they knew it was over. They grew up behind bars, years blurring into decades. Milestones were missed, families changed, and the world moved on. But for Rayshawn, Nathaniel, Christopher, Jermall, and Darrell, time stood still. Every day was a reminder of the same question. How do you prove your innocence once the system has decided you're guilty? Early on, appeals were filed and denied. There were no DNA breakthroughs, no surprise witnesses, no dramatic courtroom reversals, just silence and waiting. They watched the world outside evolve. Cell phones replaced payphones. Social media took over. And the kids they once were became men behind concrete walls, Letters from home became lifelines. And every so often, a new letter would go out, addressed to post-conviction lawyers, innocence organizations, or anyone who might listen. Most of these never got a reply. The few that did usually came with bad news. But still, their message remained unchanged. We didn't do this. Slowly, people began to listen. Law students started reading the case files. Journalists began asking questions. And whispers turned into headlines. Could the Winston-Salem Five be innocent? After countless unanswered pleas, one handwritten letter by Christopher Bryant finally landed on the right desk, the North Carolina Innocence Inquiry Commission. The commission, established in 2006 by the state legislature, was designed exactly for this kind of case, to investigate credible claims of factual innocence long after appeals were exhausted. Christopher's letter reached them in 2015. 3 years later, Nathaniel Cawthon filed his own application. By 2019, the commission had subpoenaed every record related to the case and taken custody of the physical evidence from trial, including the tape, the string from the do-rag used to bind Nathaniel Jones, and other items from the scene. Their plan? To test it all for DNA. Although investigators had checked those items for fingerprints back in 2002, they hadn't tested them for DNA at all. Meanwhile, in February 2017, after nearly half their lives behind bars, Jermall Tolliver and Christopher Bryant walked out of prison after finishing their sentences. In January of 2018, Darrell Brayboy joined them. For the first time since they were children, they were free. Darrell began to live the life he'd been denied for so long. He fell in love, became a father to a beautiful little girl, and tried to build a quiet life beyond the walls that had defined him. But his freedom would be heartbreakingly brief. In August 2019, just a year and a half after his release, Darrell stopped by a grocery store with his girlfriend to grab milk for their 8-month-old baby. His girlfriend and daughter waited in the car while he went inside. On his way in, Darrell was approached in the parking lot by his cousin. An argument over borrowed children's clothes that hadn't been returned spiraled out of control. In one single, devastating moment, the argument turned violent. Darrell's cousin pulled a knife and stabbed him repeatedly before fleeing the scene. His injuries were devastating. Wounds to his stomach, chest, and upper left shoulder, one of which severed a major artery. He also had defensive wounds along his right hand and upper arm where he tried to shield himself. He was rushed to the hospital, but the damage was too great. At just 31 years old, Darrell Brayboy's life ended in the same kind of senseless violence he'd spent years trying to escape. When Jermall got the call, he ran directly to the scene, living just down the road from that grocery store. He and Darrell had reconnected after their release and were supposed to hang out later that day. By the time he arrived, the parking lot was taped off and his friend was already gone. Darrell's cousin didn't get far. He was arrested soon after and admitted to what he'd done. He accepted a plea deal and was sentenced to 8 to 10 years behind bars. For those who loved Darrell Brayboy, this sentencing didn't bring peace, only another loss. After surviving the system that stole his youth, Darrell's life was taken by something even more senseless. When news of Darrell's death reached the prison, it spread quietly by word of mouth. Rayshawn Banner heard it from a prison guard, but he said he didn't believe it. Rumors were common inside. Stories twisted and repeated until nothing was true. But something about the guard's tone made him uneasy. He immediately went to the phones and made a call to his mother. And that's when she told him it was true. Darrell was gone. Rayshawn said later that those words hit harder than any he'd ever received. He'd spent years holding on to the hope that they'd all reconnect outside of prison together one day, that somehow all five would make it home to build the lives they always dreamed of. Now one of them never would. The headline the next morning was brutal. Man stabbed to death outside Food Lion was convicted of killing NBA player Chris Paul's grandfather in 2005. It wasn't just another tragedy. It was another judgment. To the public, Darrell was still defined by the crime he swore he didn't commit. When Jessica Black saw that headline, she broke down. She said she couldn't stop crying. Because even after all those years, she carried the weight of what she'd said in that courtroom. And now, it was too late to take it back. Just 2 months later, Jessica's phone rang. Two investigators from the North Carolina Innocence Inquiry Commission were asking for her and told her they were reviewing the case. By then, Jessica had been carrying the weight of her testimony for nearly 2 decades, and she was tired. When investigators asked if she'd be willing to talk, she didn't hesitate. This time, she said, she was ready to tell them everything. Appeals can be dismissed, and motions can be denied. But things begin to shift when the system itself starts to question what it once called justice. Independent reviewers began looking into the Winston-Salem 5 case. Lawyers, investigators, and forensic experts with no connection to the original trials. What they found was endless red flags. They saw inconsistencies in the confessions, details that didn't line up. They noticed that every statement seemed to start in the same place, not with what the boys remembered, but with what detectives had already decided was true. Experts studied the language of those interviews and concluded something chilling. The phrasing, sequence of events, and even the vocabulary were too sophisticated for 14 and 15-year-olds. These weren't boys describing a crime. They were children echoing authority. And the deeper investigators dug, the more the cracks widened. There was no physical evidence, only words. That's when the North Carolina Innocence Inquiry Commission took notice. It's one of the few agencies in the country created to re-examine cases of possible wrongful conviction. They don't take rumors or hunches, only cases where evidence suggests the verdict might be wrong. This became one of those cases. When commission investigators reached out to Jessica Black, she was carrying the weight of her testimony, and the headline about Darrell's death had shaken her deeply. As a mother, she couldn't stop imagining if it had been her own son. What the investigators didn't know was that just weeks earlier, Jessica had already broken her silence. A Houston Chronicle reporter named Hunter Adkins had been digging into the story of NBA star Chris Paul, who at the time was playing for the Houston Rockets. While researching Paul's life and murder of his grandfather, Hunter came across the court records and transcripts from the Winston-Salem 5 cases. He began reaching out to everyone connected to it, including Jessica. For more than a year, she ignored him. His persistence annoyed her. The trial was something she desperately wanted to keep in the past. But one afternoon, on a recorded phone line, as he was again requesting an interview, something began to shift. As Hunter talked, he began to reveal something Jessica hadn't anticipated. Hunter had spent time talking to the families and reviewing the interrogations. He was convinced the boys had been coerced into false confessions. And when he asked Jessica about her experience and if she had also been coerced, something in her began to unravel. For the first time, she admitted what she'd been so afraid to say for nearly 2 decades, that she had lied on the stand and that she, too, had been intimidated and threatened by the Winston-Salem detectives. Back then, she thought it didn't matter because police had told her the evidence against the boys was overwhelming. They said they had found DNA, skin cells, in her car. They said the boys had been caught using the victim's debit card, proving their guilt. They told her all kinds of things that sounded undeniable, and she had no idea, until she talked to Hunter Adkins, that none of it was true. Jessica began to question everything, her memory, her statements, and her role in the case. Jessica spent 2 full days giving a recorded deposition to the North Carolina Innocence Inquiry Commission. Everything she'd held inside since she was 16 years old. She described how detectives had pressured her, how she was threatened with being charged as an accessory if she didn't cooperate, and how she was coached by the district attorney's office to stick to a version of events that made the boys' confessions sound believable. Whenever she stumbled over details, she said they would nudge her toward the answers they wanted, guiding her with tone and hints until they reacted in a way that told her she'd finally said the right thing. She learned to read their faces, guessing until their expression changed from frustration to to approval. For example, it could have been something as simple as the color of tape. They would ask, "Are you sure it was gray?" She'd hesitate. They pressed again until she understood and would say a different color. Jessica says she was scared, confused, and desperate to get out of that room. So she went along with it all. And now, nearly 20 years later, she said the words that changed everything. That her testimony was coerced and her statements were untrue. It was a bombshell. Because the only thing that had ever placed those five boys at the scene of Nathaniel Jones' murder was Jessica's testimony. And now she was telling the system that it was a lie. In 2020, the North Carolina Innocence Inquiry Commission held hearings to review the case. For the first time in years, the entire story was back under the microscope. And on the stand, under oath, Jessica Black, once the state's star witness, repeated everything she had said in her deposition. And then came a revelation that shook Jessica to her core. Jessica learned for the first time that she wasn't just a witness in the original case. She was an alibi. The timeline the state built around her testimony, the very one used to convict the boys, was wrong. The window of time prosecutors said the attack occurred was the same period Jessica was with them, miles away from Bellevue Park. Her statements didn't incriminate the boys. They exonerated them. Back then, Jessica believed the police when they told her there was overwhelming evidence tying the boys to the crime. She thought, if they're guilty anyway, what difference does it make if I say what they want? But sitting before the commission nearly 20 years later, she finally understood just how much that lie had cost. The commission also heard from a forensic psychology expert who testified that this case had nearly every hallmark of a false confession. Juvenile suspects, lengthy, unrecorded interrogations, threats of the death penalty, and promises that cooperating meant going home. The parallels to the Central Park Five were unmistakable. Five teenagers of color, no physical evidence, and confessions that collapsed under scrutiny. After reviewing every detail, the commission reached its conclusion. There was sufficient evidence of actual innocence. The case would advance to a three-judge panel for review. It was a monumental step. Fewer than 1% of cases brought before the commission ever make it this far. It wasn't freedom yet, but it was validation. After two decades of being dismissed, ignored, and disbelieved, someone inside the system was finally saying, "We think you might be right." The panel convened in Forsyth County from April 18th through April 28th of 2022. Day after day, the families sat in the courtroom, listening, waiting, hoping that this time the truth would finally be enough. But when the ruling came, their hope shattered in an instant. The judges ruled unanimously that the defendants had not met the burden of proving their innocence by clear and convincing evidence. The motion for exoneration was denied. They were told again there wasn't enough proof, certainty, or enough to undo what had been done. The families were disappointed, frustrated, and heartbroken. But the fight was far from over, because evidence had surfaced that no one could ignore. Something buried for decades that would shake the very foundation of this case and force the state of North Carolina to finally face a question it had spent 20 years avoiding. What if they got it wrong? By 2023, two decades had passed since the night Nathaniel Jones was brutally attacked and killed in his carport on Moravia Street. And for the Winston-Salem Five, the fight for freedom hadn't stopped. The investigation by the Innocence Inquiry Commission had already run its course, but attorneys for the four defendants filed new appeals with the Forsyth Superior Court, citing Jessica Black's recantation and the mounting evidence of false confessions. This time, the court agreed to listen, and an evidentiary hearing was granted. In January 2025, a North Carolina courtroom was once again hearing the names of five boys who had long since become men. For 3 weeks, The evidence that once convicted them was put back into the light. The hearing began with clear tension as the defense and the state clashed from the start, each side revisiting the trials that had shaped these men's lives. The state insisted the original convictions were proper. The defense countered that witnesses never placed the boys at the scene, and that the confessions, along with the key testimony of Jessica Black, were coerced. Two of the original defense attorneys took the stand, and each struggled to recall details from trials held 20 years prior. The defense pushed to have all convictions overturned. They argued that the original attorneys failed their clients, and they questioned whether the boys ever had a fair defense at all. One lawyer recalled how one of the boys' original attorneys went so far as to wrongly admit in closing arguments that the boys were at the scene, effectively conceding the state's case. It was an extraordinary moment of legal reckoning, the defense arguing that justice had failed not once, but twice, in the interrogation room and again at the defense table. Veteran attorney James Cooney took the stand as an expert witness. After reviewing hundreds of hours of case files, Cooney testified that the boys' defense teams had fallen below professional standards in nearly every way that mattered. He revealed that all five defendants had been in special education programs with IQ scores near or below 70, meaning they were likely functioning with mild intellectual disabilities. Their school records showed significant struggles with reading, comprehension, and cause and effect reasoning. Yet, none of their lawyers introduced this evidence. If those records were presented, Cooney said, the court would have understood just how vulnerable these boys were to suggestion and how incapable they were of understanding the high-stakes world they'd been thrown into. The defense called Dr. Haley Cleary, an expert in adolescent psychology and police interrogations. She explained how teenagers' developing brains make them far more vulnerable to suggestion, fear, and exhaustion. She highlighted how repetition, leading questions, and intimidation tactics had likely caused both Jessica Black and the boys to conform to the story police wanted. The state went on the attack, attempting to discredit Dr. Cleary by suggesting she was biased toward her field, paid for her testimony, and even influenced by her appearance on a podcast about wrongful convictions. But Dr. Cleary didn't back down. She told the court her conclusions weren't about opinion. They were based on decades of research and hard data that juveniles don't understand the weight of their words under pressure, fear can look like guilt, and that every risk factor for a false confession was present in this case. The hearing then turned to the mountains of records collected by the Innocence Inquiry Commission. 14 boxes of physical evidence, thousands of pages of reports, and hours of recordings. Among them were the school and Department of Public Safety records that painted a heartbreaking picture of five kids who had been failed long before they ever entered a courtroom. The defense called forensic psychologist Dr. Ginger Calloway to tie it all together. She analyzed the boys' school records and IQ scores, confirming what others had hinted at all week, that each one of them exhibited signs of mild intellectual disability. Dr. Calloway testified that given their limitations, none of them could have fully understood their Miranda rights or the legal weight of the words they spoke in those interrogation rooms. Her conclusion was simple and devastating. These boys were never capable of defending themselves, because they never fully understood what was happening to them. Attorney John Fisher, who once represented Jermall, also took the stand. He admitted he never obtained school or mental health records, believing the boys' ages alone would convey their immaturity to the jury. He spoke of coercion, threats, and false promises made by police, even recalling the officer who told the boys exactly where the needle would go if they faced the death penalty. Fisher remembered one moment vividly. After the trial, the presiding judge told him, "I might should have granted that motion to suppress." A single sentence that carried the weight of 20 years. Because that motion was the defense's attempt to keep the boys' confessions out of evidence and away from the jury, confessions that to this day remain likely the only reason they were ever convicted. The judge's quiet acknowledgement was much too late, but it signaled even he knew those statements should have never made it into trial. There's one question that's haunted this case for years. Why did Jermall Tolliver's mother call police in the first place? The jury never heard the answer. Detective Rose had previously visited her house about a string of neighborhood robberies. He told her to call him if she heard anything suspicious. So when her son started acting withdrawn, she did exactly what she thought was right. She called the detective. The defense suggested that Jermall may have been scared not because of a murder, but because of the pressure surrounding those unrelated robberies, pressure that detectives twisted into something much darker. What began as a mother's attempt to protect her son became the spark that ignited the entire case. The defense then shifted focus to the forensic side of the investigation. They called the assistant director of the North Carolina Innocence Inquiry Commission. She walked the court through how the commission obtained the evidence from the Winston-Salem Police Department and sent it for DNA testing at a nationally accredited forensic lab. All of the evidence from the original case had, shockingly, never been tested for DNA at all. When they received the evidence, investigators found that it had been stored in disastrous conditions. Cardboard boxes, torn evidence bags, even the shoes said to match the footprint on Mr. Jones' car were stuffed unsealed into a ripped brown bag with the victim's bloody clothing. Years of mishandling had caused major cross-contamination concerns. Still, the commission pressed forward, determined to find out what the science would reveal. To ensure accuracy, DNA swabs were collected from everyone who might have come into contact with the evidence. The five defendants, Jessica Black, their defense attorneys, even the neighbor, Calvin Scriven, who was on scene shortly after the discovery of Nathaniel Jones' body. They wanted to rule out every known profile and see whose DNA remained. They tested the physical evidence, everything from the light bulbs unscrewed in the carport to the pieces of mail found under Mr. Jones' car. And the results were undeniable. There wasn't a single piece of evidence from that crime scene that contained the DNA of any of the five defendants. Not one. That kind of absence is powerful. How could five teenage boys be all over a crime scene, tying, beating, and dragging a man, and leave nothing on the tape, the car, or the body? And just as telling, Mr. Jones' DNA wasn't found on any of the boys' belongings either. Then came the shock that changed everything. The results revealed a previously unidentified female DNA profile on the string used to bind Nathaniel Jones' hands, a mixture of at least three people with one major female contributor. It wasn't Jessica Black or anyone connected to the five defendants. The commission tested everyone they could think of. The neighbor, Tarsha, who'd called 911, the female attorneys who'd handled the evidence. None matched. The unknown female DNA was entered into CODIS, the national database that stores DNA profiles for various law enforcement agencies. And to this day, it's never been identified. The state offered no explanation, no alternate suspect, no theory that could connect that DNA to the five boys who had spent half their lives in prison. Despite the state's objections, the court allowed those results into evidence. For the first time in two decades, science was speaking for itself, and it wasn't saying what the prosecutors once claimed. An independent footwear and fingerprint expert also testified, debunking what the state once called their smoking gun. He said the print on the car's hood was far too vague to draw any conclusions. It could have been anyone's. He said the amount of weight the original prosecutors placed on that single blurry impression was wildly overstated. The defense presented every inconsistency, forensic flaw, and revelation. They called forensic scientists, psychologists, interrogation specialists, each one pointing to the same conclusion. These were false confessions built on fear, not facts. Jessica Black again took the stand, explaining how she felt terrified and trapped. She described the detective who yelled at her so aggressively that he was spitting as he screamed in her face. She broke down in tears as she admitted that she changed her story only because she was scared and just wanted to go home. This courtroom had become a stage where two versions of justice collided. The hearing was nearing the end, and the air inside the courtroom felt heavier, thicker with 20 years of heartbreak, anger, and hope. Just one thing remained: closing arguments. The state began its closing arguments, returning to the same 4 points it had leaned on continually: Jessica Black's credibility, the defendant's mental capacity, the forensic evidence, and the claim that their original lawyers had done their jobs properly. Prosecutors insisted Jessica's story couldn't be trusted, not because she lied in 2002, but because she had changed it now. They said her recantation was unreliable, tainted by years of contact with defense teams and journalists. They also dismissed the defense's psychological testimony, arguing that while the defendants may have struggled in school as teenagers, they were fully competent adults now. And when it came to the DNA, the state tried to cast doubt, suggesting that the new testing undermined the legitimacy of the evidence originally used at trial. Then it was the defense's turn. They began with a photograph of Nathaniel Jones' carport. They reminded the judge that for all the theories and confessions, there were no eyewitnesses who saw a group of boys near that house that night. They pointed out that police spent 4 full days processing the scene before ever receiving that fateful call from Jamal Tolliver's mother. And from that moment forward, they stopped investigating and instead shifted their focus to a small group of kids. They showed the court the inconsistencies: hours of unrecorded interrogations, confessions that didn't match, evidence that didn't exist. They reminded the court of what the science now proved. The black electrical tape used to bind Nathaniel Jones' hands contained DNA from someone other than the 5 defendants. 5 boys, the defense said, and not a single molecule of them found anywhere on that scene. They accused the state of fighting to keep that DNA evidence out, not because it was unreliable, but because it was undeniable. By Friday morning, emotions had reached their breaking point. The defense called the case what it was: a failure of the justice system. They acknowledged the pain of the Jones family, their decades of waiting and need for closure. One defense attorney looked toward the families in the gallery and said, "The Jones family deserves answers, but there is no honor in a wrongful conviction." At one point, Nathaniel broke down in tears. His attorney spoke about the toll these 20 years had taken. His voice echoed through the courtroom as he cried out, "I'm fighting for my life." His mother sat behind him, clutching her hands as tears rolled down her face. When the hearing ended, she told reporters softly, "The defense brought it home in ways she never could have imagined, and that she dreamed of this day for 20 years." With closing arguments complete, there was one simple but monumental question left for the court to answer. Were 5 teenagers wrongly convicted, or was justice already served? For 7 long months, the courtroom was quiet. For the men who had spent half their lives behind bars, waiting was nothing new. But this time, they were waiting for something that could rewrite the rest of their lives. Then in August 2025, the decision finally came. The North Carolina trial judge issued a ruling that would ripple through the state's legal system. All 5 convictions overturned. All charges dismissed with prejudice. It wasn't just a legal victory. It was a reckoning. A declaration that the case itself had collapsed under the weight of its own flaws. What had once been called justice was now being called a mistake. For the first time in more than 20 years, the words innocent and Winston-Salem 5 appeared in the same sentence. The ruling cleared the records of Christopher Bryant and Jamal Tolliver, and posthumously exonerated Darrell Brayboy. For Rayshawn Banner and Nathaniel Coffin, it meant one word they had almost forgotten how to believe in: freedom. Families cried tears of joy, disbelief, and something deeper: relief that someone had finally listened. Reporters called it one of the most significant exonerations in North Carolina history. The brothers began preparing to go home to their families and the lives they left as children. They packed their belongings, made phone calls, and awaited the paperwork that would set them free. The state, however, refused to accept defeat. Admitting they were wrong wouldn't just mean revisiting a verdict. It would mean confronting the reality that they had become a part of the very injustice they were sworn to prevent. So they filed a motion to stop the release of Nathaniel and Rayshawn, and the North Carolina Court of Appeals granted it, issuing a temporary stay. For a moment, time froze again. A month later, the court lifted that stay, and the brothers were told the words they'd waited half a lifetime to hear. They were going home. They prepared to walk out the prison gates. And then, just 24 hours later, everything changed again. Before they could take a single step toward freedom, the North Carolina Attorney General's office filed a last-minute motion with the state Supreme Court, asking to keep them imprisoned while the state appealed the overturned convictions. Process that could take years. Freedom, so close they could almost taste it, was once again out of reach. Christopher and Jamal are free. Darrell, though gone, is officially cleared. But Rayshawn and Nathaniel, who have been exonerated by the courts and declared innocent by the law, are still behind bars, and their lives are once again on hold. If exonerated men are still in prison, then justice isn't justice at all. 20 years later, the murder of Nathaniel Jones and the related trials still cast a shadow over Winston-Salem. The story is a tragedy. What happens when the pursuit of justice outruns the facts, and the system built to protect us becomes the one we need protecting from? Beyond a reasonable doubt is the highest standard in our justice system. When the government accuses someone of a crime, the burden doesn't rest on the accused to prove their innocence. It rests entirely on the state to prove guilt. Not maybe, not probably, but beyond any reasonable doubt. This standard protects us all, because once freedom is taken, it can't easily be given back. And the Winston-Salem 5 case shows what happens when that standard is overlooked. Five teenagers were convicted and sent to prison for a crime they said they didn't commit. For years, those convictions stood as proof that a jury had found them guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. Their eventual exonerations are more than legal victories. They're warnings. Warnings of what happens when the presumption of innocence is overshadowed by the presumption of guilt, when fear, pressure, and narrative outweigh proof. The burden of proof is a promise that before we take a person's freedom, we must be truly sure. Because when that promise is broken, it's not just the defendants who lose. It's all of us. Doubt is not the enemy of justice. Doubt means we still care about getting it right.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.